This is a Suno India production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android app. Download it now from Google Play Store.
There is a large collection of precious artifacts collected from Britain's erstwhile colonies kept in British museums. We often hear calls from various previously colonized countries, including our own, asking for such objects back from Britain. What we hear less of in such conversations is the story of human remains. It was part of colonial practice to collect the remains of indigenous people. The Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, England, has the largest collection of Naga material culture in the world, which is around 6,466 items, including the human remains of Naga ancestors. During the pandemic and lockdown in 2020, the Pitt Rivers Museum said that they, quote, aim to be part of a process of redress, social healing, and the mending of historically difficult relationships, end quote. This is Laura Van Broekhoven, the director of the museum.
I would like to apologize to the Naga community for not having reached out earlier. We have these ancestral remains. We know that Naga communities will be the ones who know best how to take care of these Naga remains, who might want them back. So that is why now we are reaching out to see what kind of forms of redress we might find together.
Since then, anthropologists Dolly Kikon and Arkutung Longkumer have been working as part of a community-led initiative to ensure the return of the Naga ancestral remains to their rightful home in Nagaland. Hi, I am Surya Tapa Mukherjee, your host for this episode of the Suno India Show. I spoke to Dolly and Arkutung to learn more about this path-breaking work. This is the first time that repatriation of ancestral human remains have been initiated in India and even in Asia for indigenous people. Through this project, Dolly and Arkutung say they are discovering how Indian mainland scholars have also used and abused Naga ancestral remains in similar ways and that some Indian museums continue to store them. They talk about how this history of violence and oppression influences the lives of Naga people today. Dolly Kikon is a senior lecturer in the Anthropology and Development Studies program at Melbourne University. She is also a senior research associate at the Australia-India Institute. Arkutung Longkumer is senior lecturer in Modern Asia at the University of Edinburgh and senior research fellow at the Kohima Institute in Nagaland.
The conversation that we are having with the Pitt Rivers Museum is to do primarily with the ancestral human remains that belong to the Naga community of Northeast India, as well as parts of Western Myanmar. We have been in contact with them kind of officially to do with the human remains from around 2020 during the pandemic, when the Pitt Rivers Museum came up with a policy of committed to change. So that idea was to kind of decolonize their collections, primarily in partnership with the kind of source indigenous communities that these objects came from. And the Pitt Rivers Museum, of course, is a large museum which is part of the University of Oxford, and it's an ethnographic museum, and it was established in the 19th century, mid-19th century kind of onwards. And aside from the human remains, they also have a lot of material objects, artifacts that belong to communities in India, such as the Nagas, Mizos, and so on, but also they have collections from all around the world that, again, like range from like human remains to ancestral kind of objects, like ritual objects, material artifacts like body cloths, shawls, statues, and so on. So it's a large organization that has, you know, all of these. So our conversation with the Pitt Rivers Museum is primarily to do with the human ancestral remains. And they have over around 200 or so of that. And that is our primary connection with the Pitt Rivers Museum at the moment.
So how can you tell us a bit? Because, you know, when we hear ancestral remains, I feel like that already kind of makes it a bit like impersonal and maybe like a bit like dehumanizing when you sort of think about like people's remains like in museums. So can you tell us a bit about what, you know, going back to the time of colonization when all of this was happening, what was the context or what were the some of the events that led to this kind of collection? Can you share any stories of the people, you know, if you know, from whom these things were collected and kind of set more of like a context of who these people were, what happened to them that led to this collection that this museum has?
I think I'm glad, you know, that you're bringing up terms like dehumanization and, you know, when we talk about ancestral remains, the horrors that it invokes at the same time. But we have to understand that it was the empire's business to collect. Right? It was part of, you know, creating knowledge. It was part of creating the history of the colonizer. And for many, many colonized communities, particularly, I think, indigenous people, here in the context of the Indian subcontinent, the Himalayas, which includes the Naga Hills, the quest for collection, both quote-unquote artifacts and at the same time human remains, was really a part of colonizing, a part of a knowledge-producing initiative. And I would also like to stress that the process of collection that happened historically, you know, in the colonial context was not only human remains and artifacts, but definitely plants as well. And so we see, you know, during the time of colonization across continents, plants moving, animals moving, human remains being taken away. And I think in a sense, to give a context to that, in relation to India, after the transfer of power in 1947, Indian anthropologists and scholars and administrators who came to govern the northeastern frontiers of India, including the Naga Hills, in the Naga homelands, were also equally complicit in this process. So some of the first anthropological surveys of India and the kind of conversations that took place was really building on a very colonial stereotype idea. That's why in the 21st century, the Naga people as citizens are still known as savages and primitive. So in a sense, this entire collection that we're talking about not only supersedes the idea of material, but also in a sense, you know, has colonized in a country like India today in the 21st century, the idea of who is a savage and who is not. And I think it goes back both to the colonial empires, the British Empire's quest to collect from the colonized people, the indigenous people across the northeastern region of India. And also after the transfer of power in 1947, the way that indigenous Adivasi people were branded as primitives has a huge role in the way that this colonization has continued.
So what have sort of, I mean, you've already sort of mentioned this in whatever you just said, But what has sort of been some of the effects of colonization, before independence, after independence, colonization in different ways? What has been the relationship of Naga communities with colonization, and what is sort of the lasting impact that you still see?
The lasting impact would be that the Naga insurgency and the Naga demand for the right to self-determination is the longest ongoing demand in the world. The impact would be that the Naga community and society are extremely militarized, thanks to imposition of the Armed Forces Special SPAR Act since 1958. The impact would be this entire mentality of looking at Adivasi indigenous people in the Indian subcontinent only through extractive lens. The impact would be the marginalization of voices of indigenous Adivasi people who don't matter in any kind of national conversations, that needs to be taken in context. The impact would be the denial and the erasure that Naga human remains continue to be possessed, even in institutions of higher education within India, in museums, whether it's the Calcutta Museum, there are archival records showing that they have Naga ancestral human remains. And this topic is absolutely not at all visible in the context of India, given that Indian scholarship, Indian intellectuals, students have been one of the most vocal intellectuals when it comes to South Asia, whether it's history, anthropology, social sciences, but their work on Adivasi and their work on indigeneity, in a sense, as intellectual projects of justice has been shameful. So that's the impact.
I think your questions have kind of like prompted some of the highlighted some of the challenges, about thinking about human remains, ancestral remains, and so on. And I think part of the project is to try and understand this process a bit more in depth, I think. So I think currently we seem to be stuck in a process of just having the kind of descriptions, of these human remains, say, for instance, in the archives. And I think trying to understand the process and who are the key characters in this. I mean, who were the people who were involved in the process of collecting this kind of ancestral remains, say, for instance? So I mean, were they administrators? Were they kind of anthropologists? Were they, say, like military, like personnel who were kind of involved in sacking as well as burning, off these different like villages? So I think the context of who these characters are and the personalities and behind these sorts of actions, I think, need to be understood both during the British period, but also post kind of Indian independence, that stretch of, especially in the 40s and 50s and 60s onwards, where this militarization was happening all over the like Naga areas, and that kind of like traumatic experience of the people, especially as they're dealing with conflict and violence, I think it kind of helps us understand the role of human dignity in all of this, right? So I think the ancestral remains sort of brings us back. I think it helps us to pause a bit and look back at history with new lenses, I guess, and trying to understand the way power relationships kind of operated, both during the time of the British, but also post-Indian independence, with the Indian state. So I think these are important moments, I think, to intervene and to try and understand. And hopefully the Human Remains Project gives us a bit more of an insight, into the kind of like mechanisms of power that we experience still.
Right. So before continuing, I really found it shocking that when, Dolly said that the Calcutta Museum, I mean, I'm guessing it's the Indian Museum in Kolkata, has Naga ancestral remains as well. So I mean, and from whatever you said, like, I got the impression that this is not something maybe uncommon, like, within the country itself. So is there any kind of conversation or any kind of initiative or dialogue or anything at all, like, happening on that front? I mean, like, for even for basically people to even know that this is something that exists and that, you know, and all the injustices that that signifies.
Yeah, I think, you know, all of this, I think, you know, it's still, I think it's still in its preliminary stage. I think, you know, these conversations have not been happening, unfortunately. And I think part of our involvement with the Pitrovas Museum and also the piece that you have seen, you know, which was published in the, like, Murung Express first and then, of course, spread over the other channels, other, like, media channels, is to kind of like highlight the importance of this and to have a conversation with different actors, and whether they are state institutions, where they are kind of organizations, civil society, and so on. So it's very important that we kind of open up and have this kind of discussion with other institutions. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I myself don't really know the extent of, say, the kind of Naga human remains in India, and what sort of practices have been involved in preserving, in taking these human remains and being kept in, like, museums. So that's kind of another aspect of this project that, you know, will kind of unfold, especially as we broaden out the scope.
Yeah, so for you, what would it mean to sort of, you know, get all of this back? What does that mean, you know, for the community, for the land? And also, what are the sort of the processes that you'll be looking forward to once all of this is back?
Well, I guess the process is a long process. I think it's a difficult question to answer in terms of how do we think about these ancestral remains, our ancestors coming back to the homeland. But I think some of the conversations that we have been having is to kind of understand, well, I mean, as I was saying, you know, to have a more deeper understanding of the colonial history, starting from the British and then the Indian state, and how that has impacted the way we think about, well, a human dignity, the way we think about trauma, conflict, healing, as well as reconciliation. So, I mean, all of these are kind of like questions that we have that will enable us to understand the processes. But also, I think it is also important to emphasize that, you know, it's also about human dignity. It's about bringing the ancestors back home and, well, I'm giving them a proper, like, burial and kind of rest. And exactly how that will unfold, you know, we are still kind of discussing that. But I think it is also important to talk about healing of the land, you know, because I think kind of any society in, like, Northeast India, you know, has experienced a lot of trauma and conflict. And part of this is also to really allow us to kind of understand the different historical factors which have brought us to this particular situation and context, and kind of thinking about how we deal with the land and how we deal with our ancestors and how we deal with the histories. And all of these are intertwined. So I think in that sense, you know, it is important that we engage with these conversations kind of at this moment that might lead us to a more productive and fulfilling future.
So in this process so far, is there anything that, you know, is it also a process of learning? Is it also a process of discovering? In this journey, you know, have you sort of learned or discovered things that you didn't expect, or, you know, things that kind of make you look at the world maybe differently or your own history differently?
Thank you for the question. Definitely. I think the theme, you know, as fellow anthropologists, Arkutanga and myself, and also with the Naga team looking at this process and at this journey has been deeply traumatic to be honest. You know, the level and the depth of colonization and the violence, and also the complete erasure and indifference, right, of the Indian state, and also kind of that conversation here in the Indian context is both appalling, but at the same time, I guess, you know, enraging, to be honest. Since India's independence, we have looked at some of the conflicts, you know, and the Naga armed conflict really comes to mind when we talk about militarization. When we talk about the perseverance to kind of heal, right, the kind of the Naga people's commitment to find peace and also reconcile with the militarization and with the violence of the land. And coming back to your question about what have we learned since we started this journey of, you know, the repatriation of our Naga ancestral human remains, it has really taken us to a very deep level of realizing and also looking at the trauma that we still carry with colonization. I have to underline that the process of decolonization in the Indian subcontinent was a deeply fractured one, right? We have to agree that at the time of the transfer of power between the British Empire and the government of India, many of the indigenous people in the Eastern Himalayas and also across the world faced a fracture in their demand for sovereignty. And the Naga people are and can be counted as one of the communities who were really left with the brunt of the transfer of power. And in this process of looking at the repatriation of Naga ancestral human remains, I think we have begun to see how is it that we not only travel to the past to understand how human remains were taken away and, you know, how our ancestors were hung like clowns, like puppets on museums across Europe, and maybe were also given away as gifts by Indian scholars after the transfer of power in 1947. Scholars, historians, anthropologists who came to work in the northeastern frontiers of India have stories, anecdotes, how Naga human remains, skulls, part of their bones, were actually exchanged as gifts, you know, for amusement. Naga skulls, our ancestral Naga skulls, were also used as paperweights by some of the Indian scholars who came to this frontier region to study my people. And these are all stories which are coming out, and it's also very deeply troubling that only once Naga scholars came up and raised the issue of the repatriation and how our ancestral remains have actually been treated for centuries, like marbles, like toys, like a piece of joke. It has really, in a way, struck how the process of citizenship, the experiences of indigenous people, Nagas, Adivasis, really requires a lot more deep thinking about among citizens in India.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's also, you know, I mean, for me personally, like, I think it's very interesting how, like, the British in the UK don't learn about, you know, like, colonization, really. And, you know, how we have sort of oppressed, you know, our own indigenous people. And we sort of, like, don't learn about those sides of things and those sides of our history. So whatever you are discovering and learning, do you think... you know, like, are you also thinking of ways, or like, you also have hopes of, you know, this becoming common knowledge at some point? Because, you know, like, in terms of healing, like, first there has to be the acknowledgement of, like, everything that has happened. So how do you sort of think that, you know, that this knowledge can, you know, be shared or like recorded in a way that is accessible?
That's really a good question. And I think before we begin to even think of this process as knowledge, I think we have to, you know, we are encountering as a team the reality of conditioning, right? And what colonial conditioning does to us. So there is also a denial, that such things happened. There is also perhaps just a reaction that, let it be, it's in the past. Why are you so bothered to look at a heap of bones, right, lying somewhere in Europe? It doesn't matter. We have progressed. And I think it brings us back, in a sense, to look at conditioning and why is it that in this process, more as much as healing and reconciliation is important, the perhaps the goal is also to look at the process of decolonization, right? And how do we see this happening? And I think for me, then decolonization, reconciliation, and definitely, the idea of a shared just future all comes together.
Yes, and I think, one of the impact of our project, and especially as we are slowly kind of opening it up, as you were kind of asking, is that, we are also trying to build kind of networks with other indigenous communities from around the world. So it's not only about the Naga story, kind of, although, I mean, for us, that is the main focus, but we are also trying to engage with other actors, who have had similar experiences, and we can learn and share with them. The other impact, I think, is also the amount of participation which is already happening in the, in the Naga homelands. When Dolly was giving a public lecture a few weeks ago, the scale of public engagement, especially the youth, and all from all kind of over. Nagaland as well as Naga society, different genders, age groups, and all of that congregated to kind of listen to her talk. And the kinds of questions and the kinds of insight, challenges, queries that people had, I think really gives us a glimpse of the deep concern and the deep care that people have in order to really go back and understand our history, because kind of understanding the past actually then strengthens the present and the future. So I think in that sense, the project has kind of opened up a lot of possibilities to understand our history better, possibilities to really appreciate the present, but also be kind of open to a promising future. And I think those are... Well, of course, here, it's primarily rhetoric, right? I'm just speaking. But, I am hopeful that this project has kind of opened up a tiny hole, in this vast kind of landscape of ours, to really probe and really understand, our current situation. So I think in that sense, I'm really optimistic that the different people that we are engaged with, will come up with some of the answers that, all of us are trying to grapple with as well. So it's a collective kind of endeavor as well.
If I may add to, I think what my colleague Arko is saying, it was only through starting this journey and, thinking about the human and repatriation and healing, did I encounter a research team called the Return, Reconcile, Renew, RRR, which is an Australian research team. And it was this team who provided us with a database and also the training on repatriation of ancestral remains. And it was Return, Reconcile, and Renew research team who informed us about Naga human remains across Indian museums and institutions. They were very clear that there are remains there. And so I think we're looking at the process of decolonization and for young people across mainly to reconsider how is it that we see the future, right? And how is it that we actually embrace the process of decolonization? It should be easy, right? If it's there in Kolkata Museum, if it's there in any of the science labs in, across universities, I think at this day and age, we should not be using Naga ancestral remains. We should not be using Adivasi human remains for lab tests. I think it's high time that we kind of revisit such a colonizing framework to understand the creation of knowledge. There's no roadmap. Nothing of this kind on the repatriation of ancestral human remains have been initiated in the Indian subcontinent, or even, I think, across Asia as well, among indigenous people. It's one of the first initiatives that we are starting.
Right, yes. So like for a layperson, might think that, okay, so the museum is friendly, the museum is cooperating with you. So like you just get the remains and then, you bring them back and then you lay them to rest. But it's not as simple as to prepare the community, to locate the context in which it was taken and find out what are the best ways to lay it to rest, how it can impact the community where it's going back. So it's that's the whole process. Is that right?
So Surya Tapa, maybe I'll just very quickly tell you that, the Naga ancestral human remains are actually private property of the University of Oxford. So governments are not involved, and these were collections given to a museum within the University of Oxford. So there are actually legal details that we need to look at. And of course, governments getting involved will come at a later stage. Just in a sense of, I'm so glad that Surya Tapa is putting that, the understanding of what a layperson would think, right? That we are demanding and it's going to come and rest. I think during the time of the pandemic, if we're looking at visa regulations that, even living human beings can't get, visa appointments for, to travel overseas. You can imagine we're looking at centuries of, a collection, human remains in a foreign museum, which is actually not even, a public collection. It is a private property of a university, and then we're looking at the stories that other indigenous communities have shared with us. What it means to actually repatriate. How do you clear customs? We will need government bodies to be involved. Where do they return to? Right? What kind of burials will they have? So I think these are really soul-searching questions and important ones at that, that I think we need to dwell on. And we don't have a roadmap. What we have is actually goodwill, solidarity, and yet the determination to make sure that the conversation about ancestral human remains and the conversation about decolonization takes place and starts here in the Indian subcontinent.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I like that idea of we have no roadmap, but we have lots and plenty of goodwill. So I think that's important to emphasize that, like Dolly just said. But I think, yes, I think the process is very legalistic. I mean, of course, we have to really try and understand the specific context of these human remains, which are then, of course, kind of written up in, into a report. Then submitted to the university court, and then it's approved on that level, and then it comes back to the museum and the communities, and then of course the process of how exactly do we repatriate all of these human remains. I mean, kind of in terms of resources, in terms of visa kind of regulations or bureaucracy, kind of in terms of travel, in terms of what exactly do we do after they arrive at a certain place, the kinds of protocols in place, the kinds of burial. So, I mean, all of these questions are still formulating, I think. It's not that we have solid kind of answers to any of this. I think, it's a matter of taking it one step at a time. And I think, these steps will become clearer as we progress more into the project. But yes, it is a complicated, complex, and time-consuming one, which will take at least a few more years, I would kind of imagine.
So I've asked all the questions that I had. Is there anything that you want to add or any experience that you had in this process that you want to share before we close?
I think like Arko said, you know, this is a new process for us, and we are very open to conversations. It was decided as a team that, you know, we will share the news to the public, to our fellow travelers in, you know, 2022. So the first piece that we wrote on the ancestral, I think, you know, human remains and repatriation, purposely was in a local English daily in Nagaland called Murung Express. And we are, I think, very determined that, you know, whether it is the conversations that we are having, or whether it's a process of reflection that we are doing, the Naga value of community, the kind of the principles on what has hurt us, you know, through militarization, and what are the possibilities to reconcile, are things that we embrace and we keep it close to our heart. I want to emphasize that this is a community-led, bottom-up approach. And that is why we are willing to take time to make sure that as Naga people, we understand what we are uncovering and what is it that we wish to put it to rest, our ancestors. I feel that, you know, as we go through this journey, there will be stories, there will be experiences that we will encounter. And I, you know, appeal to our listeners here, as they are listening to us, to hold us, you know, in their thoughts, to hold us in their hearts, because it's not easy for the Naga people, for Naga researchers, for Naga community to be dealing with this. We have an ongoing Indo-Naga ceasefire, and we want, you know, a final resolution. We want to make sure that the Naga future and the future generation, you know, have a chance, in a sense, to live in peace. And so there are so many strings that come together in this process, but it's a commitment to peace, it's a commitment to justice and to decolonization. And as Naga scholars, Arko and I are extremely, I think, humbled, honored, and committed that we hold on to the process of decolonization, and we continue the journey with other scholars and with other thinkers in the subcontinent and beyond that as well.
To learn more about their work, please see the Murung Express article they co-authored and Dolly's public lecture on the subject. Both are linked in the episode description.
Thank you for listening to this episode. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android app. Download it now from Google Play Store.